Let's get started. Brochim Abayim to everybody. This is, I believe, our second women's shiur since the whole Corona Parsha, the second uniquely women's shiur. The first one, though, was completely on Zoom. So this is a Baruch Shehechiyanu. This is our first live and in-person shiur since our lives have been turned upside down. But I guess there are some silver linings, because I don't think it ever would have dawned on us 3 or 4 months ago. We should also simultaneously Zoom a shiur so that people who can't come could also watch. And I have no idea how many will end up watching, but at the moment there are 6 other women who are watching on Zoom, so the Torah is increasing, Baruch Hashem. Anyway, okay, without further ado, let's get started. The topic for today's shiur, in case anyone had any doubt, was inspired by current events. And this is Tarti Mashma. I mean that on 2 levels. First of all, I assume that all of us are aware of the unrest that is turned America and in many other parts of the Western world upside down. All of us in this room have more or less connections to people in various Anglo countries, but the truth is, even yesterday, Alana and I went into the Ezor Tasiya to look at some backyard furniture, and the Baal Ebat team there at that store, you know, as Israeli Lagamre for many generations, they don't have any cousins in Teaneck, shall I say. And the first thing they wanted to know when they saw us is, what's going on in America? And Nebuch for America? So this is on people's minds, and without getting into the politics of it, obviously, but the pictures, the stories, it's tragic, it's scary. And the truth of the matter is, it's not only scary or tragic for those of us who have family in America, or even think about the Jewish community in America, although that's obviously also true. But the reality is, again, without getting political or without elaborating on anything, but so much in the world, which is good, is enabled by a prosperous America and the good values that it represents. It is not good for anybody in the world, obviously not the Americans, but not good for anyone in the world, including Israel and beyond, when America is having such a difficult time. And therefore, this is really a moment of crisis, not only for America and other Western countries, but also for the whole world. So on the one hand, that's in Yonah Dioma. On the other hand, for those of us Dafka in Eretz Yisrael, Parshat HaShavua is Korach. It's still Shlach everywhere else in the world. For a few more weeks, we're still off, because the second day of Shavuot, when we already did Naso, and they still had not started yet. But for us in Korach, I thought, given what's going on, and Parshat HaShavua for Korach, obviously that is the Parsha of Machlokes. And we know from many other examples in the Torah and in Tanakh, that not only can we learn from life and Torah sources things to do when we see the right thing, but we can also often learn what to do from looking and studying stories where they clearly didn't do the right thing. And I thought that the opportunity is too great to pass up to study the story of Korach, both in terms of Mefarshim on the Parsha, as well as Mefarshim and Pirkei Avos, who also talk about Korach and one celebrated Mishnah, and to use both of those as twin Mekorot to try to give us some insight for how we can see this broader picture of Machloket. And even though, Baruch Hashem, even if we were not in Eretz Yisrael, I don't think we necessarily would be the people who are completely convulsed in what's going on, but especially since we have the schut of being removed from it, it's not just as a hopefully an insight and a proper perspective on what's going on in the world, but obviously even if it's not nearly as extreme, it's no question that in recent history, in past history, and even in current events, it's not exactly like the Jewish people or the Jewish community is exactly completely free of machloket. We all have machloksim. There are machloksim in the big picture, the ideological machloket. And then there's the machloket of everyday life. Everyday life sometimes is husband and wife. Everyday life is sometimes parents and children. Sometimes neighbors. Sometimes, olmat kila ha'ila, the community and the rabbi. That's also a Korach topic, maybe another year. Hopefully we'll always be halacha v'lo l'maaseh. This is a topic that as long as they're human beings in a human condition, there will be machloket, and therefore it's important for us to study to see what the Torah, what Chazal have to say about it. Now, we could really go on forever, which we won't, but what I want to do is I want to divide up my discussion into answering 2 questions. Just 2. The first question I want to discuss is, how can we disagree without things escalating? it's inevitable that there will be differences of opinion. The Gemara already tells us, Masechet Sanhedrin, Kashem Shepartzufehim Shonin, Deoton Shonot, just like everyone has a different face, people think differently, people will approach the same issue differently. Some people are more innately conservative, some people are more innately liberal, open, closed, whatever, everything you can imagine. That's the human nature. So there's always going to be disagreement. Disagreement does not necessarily mean machloket. So how can we, that's what question number one is, since inevitably there'll be disagreements, how can we make sure that those don't become raging machloket? That's question number one. And question number two, which I'd also like to discuss, is when and if, unfortunately, we individually, in our family, in our community, in our neighborhood, if we do find ourselves in something that unfortunately has to be labeled a machloket, how can we get out of it? You know, a lot of times in life, you catch you slip, you trip, but you can catch yourself from falling. And there's other times in which you feel yourself falling and spinning, and you're trying to pull yourself out of that, and you can't get out. And that's when you really get hurt. So even if we fall into the machloket, how can we pull ourselves out, hopefully, before the damage is really done and irreversible? How can we get out of machloket if we get in? So I guess you could say, I didn't think about it until this moment, but I guess you could say really what I'm saying is two parts. One is the preventative. How can we avoid it? And the other one will be the cure. If we are in it, how can we try to get out of it? So I'd like to suggest five approaches, time permitting, five insights, five approaches based on Korach to answer the first question. How can we make sure not to escalate disagreement? How can we make sure that the inevitable differences of opinion do not become raging, corrosive, damaging, painful machlokas? So the first suggestion I'd like to make comes from many sources, but I'll focus for a moment on an insight, a drasha, of the great Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. He is the author of many things, including a book of drashot called the Ya'arot Dvash. And in one of his drashot there, he makes the following point. The key to having a disagreement without a machlokes is to make sure that it doesn't become personal. Focus on the issue, and you can disagree all you want about the issue, but don't let it become personal. He is discussing the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, the famous Mishnah, which uses the machlokes of Korach in the story in our Parsha as the paradigm, as the classic example of Ezuhi machloket shelo l'shem shamayim, Korach v'adato. So he asks the obvious question. If you were to take a poll of any people in any machloket, you could go from the United States Congress to the Knesset, you could go from, I don't know, the Balkans to the Canadian Rockies, it could be ideological, it could be two neighbors, it could be anything. You ask them, raise your hand if you're shelo l'shem shamayim. Everyone always thinks they're the l'shem shamayim. Who's that? How? It doesn't help me. You can give me pieces of advice about what to do if you're Korach, not to be Korach. Everyone, of course, you know, raise your hand if you're pro l'shem shamayim. Right? That's too easy, or in certain senses, too hard, because no one can ever see themselves with the proper mirror. So he asks, how are we going to know? How do we know if we are l'shem shamayim or not? Now, one could give many answers to that question, but Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz, his answer to the question is as follows. He says, you have to ask yourself, you know, this takes honesty too, how do I relate to the person I'm disagreeing with beyond the actual disagreement? When I'm discussing the disagreement, when we're debating it or whatever, okay, muvan me'elav v'shteitzach, that, you know, that might be a little bit tense. Okay, I can hear that. But what about everything else? When you interact with that person, you see the person in carpool, you see the person in shul. If it's l'shem shamayim, then it won't affect your relationship beyond the actual disagreement. If you find that it's already affecting your relationship with the person, the way you view the person, so clearly, then it's no longer about the issue. Again, you may be right, that's not the point. But it's not about the issue anymore, now it's about the person. Since that's already a line too far drawn. Now, we could discuss, you could even quibble, should that be the right litmus test? for l'shem shemayim, lo l'shem shemayim. I don't know, maybe. But one thing I think for sure, that he is for sure right about, or at least that we could say in light of what he's saying, is there's no question that if we could just always ask ourselves this question and guard against it becoming personal, there's no question that we would significantly reduce the amount of escalation, the damage, the real fighting, the community heartbreak, the famine. What is worse? What is so painful? Sometimes you see this, Nebuch, I hope no one in the room deals with this, but plenty of people unfortunately do, the machloksim, the rip apart families. I remember, you know, it's been many years, but more than once, I paid a shiva call to siblings who wouldn't sit with each other. What could be... In the end, by the way, 2 points. Number one is, on the one hand, if you ask, how did it get that far? Either they can't remember if that's how stupid it was. And the other answer, of course, is always money. It's usually, when you have a family really divided, it's very rare that it's not about money. It could be, but rare. Either way, is there anything more tragic? And the answer is, again, who knows who's right? It could be it was a real issue. But it's one thing when it's the issue that you could live with. When it becomes personal, already we're dealing with something on a much, much higher level, and then we're starting to go into a tailspin. Rahman al-Salam, you're a pilot who loses control of the plane, or, you know, tzanchan, or a parachute. Once you're in that tailspin, then it gets very hard to pull out. The first advice is, keep it about the issue, and do everything you can not to make it personal. Number one. Number two, this is going to sound so obvious, so elementary, but just because it's obvious and elementary doesn't mean it's not true. Adarabba. It's the most obvious points. Maybe Shoshana, close the door. Just if or ask them to lower the, or ask them to walk away. Huh? I think so. We can open that door, but just ask them maybe to not talk so much near the door. Anyway, so it's going to sound obvious, but as the Masil Yesharim very famously says, the greatest truths are the most obvious ones that we forget. In English, right, there's a saying, right? The greatest truths are the ones that hide in plain sight. So just because it's obvious doesn't mean, of course, that we don't need to review it. So this is going to sound obvious because it is, but I can't tell you how often people don't do this. And I guess we could say, Dan Kafschus, they forget to do it. And the second point is simply, you have to talk to the other side. It will not get better if you just hold it in and let the resentment grow and fester. It could be that somebody's a tzaddik and just lets it go. Okay, those things happen. But if we're talking about something more serious and people are relatively normal, if you're already at the point where you have a serious disagreement, it's almost never going to disappear on its own. You have to really talk it through. And this is something that both in the Torah text and Chazal amplify in our Parsha, we see what is really one of the underappreciated sources of the problem. The Torah itself tells us in this week's Parsha about how Moshe wanted to speak to Dathan and Aviram. He approached them. See if he could reason with them. They wouldn't listen. They wouldn't talk to him. And the Medrash, perhaps inspired by that, this is not in the Torah, but in the Medrash and Bamidbar Rabbah, the Medrash paints a very specific description about how Moshe wanted to even talk with Korach, but Korach made a conscious decision, I'm not talking to Moshe. I'm not talking to Moshe. And the Medrash actually says, because Korach said to himself, I know if we get into a discussion, he's going to convince me. I don't want to be convinced. And therefore, I'm going to avoid actually talking to him. Now again, this sounds crazy, but fact is stranger than fiction. This actually happens all the time. People will avoid talking going forward, not because they're worried about it could be awkward, it could be confrontational. I mean, that is true too. But sometimes people aren't talking because, like Korach, they don't want it to be resolved. And the answer is, we all know this, that, again, most of the time, not all the time, most of the time, it's not a guarantee that it'll solve the problem, but it has the distinct possibility of helping. Now, it's true, sometimes the issues are so stressful and strenuous, sometimes you need a third party to be a mediator. Okay, that's fine. but it's still talking to each other. The fact you have a third party helping doesn't mean there aren't, the two people aren't, the two sides aren't talking to each other. If you don't talk to each other, what happens? Number one is people dig in. When you talk to each other, you're forced to listen to the other side. An issue which we're going to get to in a few minutes anyway. But when we don't talk, we dig in, we assume the worst, and the more distant we are from the person, the more likely, this we all know from human nature, the more likely we are to behave in a more negative or belligerent way than we would otherwise. One of the things that social media and the internet has taught us is the more distant we are, the more likely we are to talk in a way we wouldn't talk in person. I imagine many of us have been guilty of that more than once, and probably many of us have been on the receiving end, or at least witnessed it. I can tell you, I've certainly been on the receiving end more than once, in which people who are the nicest, calmest, bemet, sincere, good people, but when it's in an email or a text, all of a sudden they talk like they never would if they were actually talking to me. Now, part of that is because I'm the rabbi, but it's not just the rabbi. When you're dealing with another person, most people, not everyone, some people are very confrontational no matter what, but most people, just the fact that they're looking another person in the face, it already lowers the temperature. If you're not going to talk, very, very unlikely that you'll be able to overcome the problem. And I saw just this afternoon a remarkable insight from Shimon Schwab also on this very point. Not talking about our Parsha, but talking about Korach. I mentioned before the famous Mishnah. What is a machloket l'shem shamayim? Hillel and Shammai. What's a machloket shelo l'shem shamayim? Korach v'adato. So many, many mefarshim note the obvious problem with that Mishnah. The language is totally imbalanced. If the machloket l'shem shamayim is Hillel versus Shammai, what would we expect the machloket shelo l'shem shamayim to be? Korach ve Moshe, not Korach ve Adato. So a lot of Mefarshim note that incongruity, the imbalance. And I saw, you know, beautiful interpretation, mamash in line with the point we're just making from a Schwab. He says, because when you have a machlokas l'shem shamayim, even if you think you're right, a point which we're going to get to in a few minutes, but even if you think you're right, you understand that there's another side. Hillel thought you should light one candle on the first night, two candles on the second night, chargah. But they understood where Beit Shammai was coming from. Understood. Rav Moshe Feinstein thought he had one shita, but he understood where Rav Soloveitchik was coming from. Rav Yashiv had a shita, but he understood where Rav Kook was coming from, whoever. If it's a shem shamayim, you understand that there's another approach. You could think it's wrong, you might be right, but you understand. Said Rav Schwab, in the machloket shelo l'shem shamayim with Korach, since all they were consumed with was the winning and the kavod that they were going to get, they couldn't even see the other side. There was no one there. It's Korach v'adato, because he wasn't really arguing with Moshe. From their perspective, there was no other side. It's all about them. And this, I realize it's a beautiful, beautiful insight. It's also a truism. And I think it really connects to this point we're making. If you're not willing to talk to the other person, if there's not even emotion on the other side, I can't talk to my spouse, I can't talk to my neighbor, I can't talk to my coworker, I'm just going to resent them, be angry at them. So then it's Korach v'adato. And that's already, not only l'shem shamayim, but more importantly, it's not going to get better. That's the second point. You got to talk to the other side, you got to try to work it out. Number three. Again, this is going to sound so simple and obvious, but it's so hard sometimes. And that is, you have to keep your head. Don't lose control. When we lose control, without exception, we say things that we regret that make things worse. We do things that we wish we didn't, that we hadn't, that'll make things worse. Because even for a moment when we lose control, Rachmana Litzlan is like someone driving a car on the highway. How long does it take, God forbid, to have a catastrophic accident? Not paying attention? A millisecond. Sometimes you can quickly catch back. but not always. Sometimes it just takes a second. If you stop paying attention, if you stop paying attention to yourself, if you lose control even for a second sometimes, if you lose your head in the heat of the disagreement, it could be catastrophic. The Gemara in Sanhedrin is a very well-known Gemara, Maimer Chazal. I would say this even to a men's shir, but especially to a woman's shir. The famous Gemara about the wife of On ben Peles. In the opening psukim of our parsha, it tells us, Korach, 250 men, Dasan, Aviram, and On ben Peles. This guy we never heard of before. What's more fascinating is not that we never heard of him before, is that when you skip to the end of the story, and the earth opens up and swallows Korach, Va'adoso, and Dasan, and there's no reference. What happened to On ben Peles? He's not there anymore. So the Gemara very famously says that On ben Peles was saved by his wife. Because most of the other people who were fighting with Moshe were from Shevet Levi. And therefore, in theory, if they could defeat Moshe, if they could show that he was an illegitimate leader, they personally would have gained from that. All of a sudden, they would have a new position. They wanted to get... Again, Chazal tell us they were upset with Moshe taking his leadership. They were upset at the, you know, people taking things away from Bechor. They stood to gain. Now, if you tell me, is it legitimate to have a machlokes with Moshe Rabbeinu because you want covered, because you'll gain? That sounds like the ultimate lo l'shem shamayim. The answer is it was. It was a rishus. But it was a rishus that we could at least understand. We're not legitimizing what they did. Of course not. But you could understand and have a little rachmanis, if you will, on the Yetzer Hara. I'll never forget, I had one of my earliest years, I think maybe my first year as a rabbi of Baltimore. A man came into my office, somebody who I barely knew. I was a new rabbi, and he wasn't a regular congregant. But I can tell you, just as using the stereotypes that we do, I'm sure women have stereotypes for each other. If you first meet someone, you're already thinking, how frum is that person or not? So there's some female stereotypes. So with a male who I saw in shul, this is a guy who put his talis over his head. He shuckled when he davened. I saw he had children who were close to my age, who seemed to be really B'nai Torah. And he tells me he has a confession to make. I thought that was a different religion. But, I can't give him absolution, but you can talk to the rabbi. Anyway, he tells me, I didn't know this, he's a Baal Tshuva, but a Baal Tshuva for decades. Not a recent Baal Tshuva, decades. And he tells me recently, he's been Mechal Shabbos. Like a few times, not once, not by accident. He's been driving on Shabbos in the afternoon. At the time, his wife didn't know, his kids didn't know. His kids lived in a different part of town. And he would tell his wife, I'm going to go walk to the kids to see them on Shabbos afternoon. And he would get in the car, and he drove, and he parked around the corners, and no one saw. And then he'd walk into his kids. They thought he walked from the other neighborhood. He told me this. I said to myself, thank God I was sitting down. Because I would have fallen off my chair. I would have totally fallen down. And I remember thinking afterwards, again, I don't have to be ma'arich too much, to be too explicit, but it's not what I was expecting. A man, a middle-aged man, comes to me, clearly, he was white, he was ashen. Rabbi, I have a confession. I thought he was going to describe different Yetzer Haras. Now, I wouldn't have approved of those either. But certain other Yetzer Haras you could understand. At least as a man, I could understand for sure. What's the Yetzer Hara of a middle-aged for a man just driving on Shabbos afternoon? I could not understand it. And I have to say, it affected the way I looked at him. I very hard time rachmanis on him. Whatever he was going through, he was going through. But in essence, that's what On ben Peles' wife says. What are you doing? The other 250 people, okay, it's wrong. But they have a Yetzer Hara. They have a Yetzer Hara for Kavod. They have a Yetzer Hara for Gaiva. They're going to get something. A person steals. Horrible, terrible. But don't we understand? Do we understand the people of Yetzer Hara for money? Of course we understand. But says his wife, what are you going to gain? You're not a Levi. You have nothing to be gained from this. And he's so convinced by it. Actually, I take it back. He's really not so convinced by it. But she gets him tired, drinks a little bit. She makes sure that he's sleeping when the crowd goes by. The bottom line is she saves him. Now, the Gemara says about this trick, this advice that his wife gave him, Chochmas Noshim Bansa Besa. The famous Pasuk. Okay. Chochmas Noshim Bansa Besa. Ask Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, the Rosh Hashiva of the Mir. I don't understand. He says, her advice was very good. But it was common sense. It was so obvious. You need to be Chachmas Nashim to figure that out. That's a Bina Yisera only a woman could have thought of. His wife was a special Chachama. She did 5 Yechidot. A genius. Baharan. Top schools. What's the Chachmas Nashim Bonsa Besa? It's so obvious. It's so common sense. What are you mixing in? You're not going to get anything for it. Would you agree to be the driver in a bank robbery when they're not even going to give you any of the money? No one would do that. It's ridiculous. This is the Chachmas Nashim of Owen Ben Pelos' wife. So says Rav Chaim Shlomitz, that's exactly the point. When everyone else is doing crazy things, just to have Seichel HaYashar is a Chachma. What he's really describing, which we now see, frankly, in America and other places, is the power of the mob. Right? When all of a sudden everyone gets around you, meshuga, and crazy, it's hard to think straight. Just to be able to have Seichel HaYashar, common sense, is not so common when everyone else around you is being crazy. Just to be able to see clearly, just to think straight, keep your cool. Don't get caught up. Don't do meshuga of things. I was reminded when I saw this, just because it's such a powerful line, it's a famous line, I will mention it. You know who Rudyard Kipling is? From England? Rudyard Kipling was a great, he lived in the earlier part of the 20th century. He was a poet, he was a novelist, he was a journalist, a brilliant, brilliant person. Yes, he's a very well-known author. So he also published a number of books, poems, of which I've never read any, except for one. I think it's, to me, the non-poetry lover, it's his most famous poem, I think, it's called If. And it's a poem, a letter he wrote to his son, if you'll do X, Y, Z, P, D, Q, A, B, C, D, Gimel, Alphabet, Gimel, if you do all these things, you will be a man. This is advice to his son. Very, very famous poem. In the opening sentence of the poem, he says, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs. Seems so obvious. Keep your head. Seichel HaYashar, common sense. The answer is when everyone around you is losing their mind, and there's a mob, lo kol kach pashut. Not so easy to keep your mind. That, you want to be a man? You want to be a good person? That's what Owen Ben Pelos' wife helped him with. Just common sense, Seichel HaYashar. Don't lose your mind. Don't get caught up in all sorts of other things. Number three. Number four. A lot of times we get caught up in machloksim, which are sometimes mamish petty, silly, narishkeit, shtuyot. Sometimes they're a little bit more important than that, but they're still very personal or private. Maybe it's financial. It could be all, every other gamut of the person, of the human condition. But then there's a whole other category of machloket, ideological, religious. Right? Now, many times that could be machloket l'shem shamayim. I truly believe that Medinat Yisrael was a bracha from Hashem, and my good neighbor, the Satmar Rebbe, you know, Rav Hilfli, I truly believe it's a maaseh satan. Again, elu ve'elu derel kimchaim, fine. Kishet, as we said in the beginning, it's inevitable. Of course, there are disagreements, different approaches to things. However, if you get yourself caught up in one of those kind of machlokes. Now, there's no one in this room, even me, and I don't think anyone else for sure not, we're not like setting the agenda for this community or that community. We're not the Bali Plukta in the big hashkafik or hachlakik machloksim. But that doesn't mean that we don't get caught up in this stuff. You could have a cousin, a neighbor, a friend, someone from a different part of the community. You have a machlokis about this, about that. Carpool, a million things. We often, you know, we live in a neighborhood that is not yet perfect in this area. Not Gan Ha'ila, obviously, but the broader. But it's not limited to Ramat Beit Shemesh. In all seriousness, it's not me being defensive. But I do get defensive when people make Ramat Beit Shemesh jokes. Well, because there's nothing that happens here that doesn't happen in 10 other cities in Israel and around the country. Is it good? Of course it's bad. It's not good. But it's not unique. It's not unique. Very, 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 very few things are uniquely problematic here. And many things are uniquely good. But the bottom line is, any of us living here or anywhere else we would be living, with broader, we have diverse families, we have friends, other people we know, we are sometimes provoked. You know, and we want to get Lashem. So, point number four is, if you find yourself in that kind of a situation, your guard has to be especially up. Because we are all hardwired, we're particularly prone to escalate things if it's an ideological or something that's religious. If we can somehow mix into our brain as part of the machlokes, Hashem, the hayashar v'hatov, the right and the good, then all of a sudden that is a very explosive mix. Religion is the most powerful thing in the world, l'tov, but it's also the most powerful thing for bad. The Rabbi Yisrael Salanter made an unbelievable point. It's somewhat cynical, if you will, almost. It's hard to believe it would be, of all people, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, but it really just means that you just see his brilliance of understanding human nature. The Mishnah, again, we're repeating it for the third time. The Mishnah that says, Machloket l'shem shamayim is Hillel v'shamayim, right? Lo l'shem shamayim is Korach v'Hadassah. What we didn't mention yet is the extra point. What does the Mishnah say about those machlokes? So it says the Mishnah something somewhat surprising. A machlokes l'shem shamayim sofo l'hitkayim. It will endure. A machloket shelo l'shem shamayim sofo lo l'hitkayim. Now, I have to say, the first time I read the Mishnah, it was very counterintuitive. If machlokes is bad, so wouldn't we want the good machlokes to end? Isn't that a siman? It's a good machlokes. It's temporary. They disagree. Hey, why is that a sign of a good machlokes? L'shem shamayim, they're sofol hitkayim. We want them to be fighting forever? This is the big yishakayach, the big reward we give Hillel and Shammai. They're going to fight forever? Sofol hitkayim? What's going on? So, again, many, many different perushim. But Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said a little bit of a twist. He said, if the people think that they're going to be l'shem shamayim, if they think they're fighting the wars of God, so fol hitkayim, it's never going to end. For myself, for this, okay, at some point you say, genig, die, it's enough already. But for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you want me to mevater? For me, I would be mevater, but this is not my covet. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's covet. I can't be mevater. Oh, I'm fighting the Chamot Hashem. Says Rasul Salanter, oy vavoy. Once it's L'shem Shamayim, you got to be careful. Because those kind of machloksim could go on forever. Because after all, we're fighting the wars of God. Rav Ruderman, Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael in Baltimore. So I heard, I don't know if it's written anywhere, but I heard this from Rav Yisachar Frand once. He said the name of his rabbi, Rav Ruderman. There's two psukim in Koheles. One says in Perek Zion, the second pasuk, Yud Zion, Al Tirshah Harbe. Don't be too wicked. You're a little Russian. Al Tirshah Harbe. But the pasuk right before that says, Al Ti Tzadik Harbe. Don't be too much of a tzadik. So as Rav Ruderman, so apparently they're both bad. Shlomo HaMelech says, Al, don't. Don't be tzadik Harbe. Don't be a Russia Harbe. Ask Rav Ruderman, which one is worse? Which one is worse? What kind of question is that? Instead of Ruben, you know what's worse? Alti tzadik harve. That's worse. Because a Rasha harve, at least there's a chance he'll do tshuva. A tzadik harve? He'll never do tshuva. What, me do tshuva? Ich bin a tzadik. It's not about me, it's about Hashem. You know how many people have been destroyed, all l'shem shamayim? Lives destroyed. People, they'll run over you in the middle of the street on the way to Marv, so to speak. Sometimes it's not only so to speak, but it's certainly al derech mashal as well. If it's a tzadik harbe, if it's a machlokes shemayim, so again, sometimes we get involved in such machloksim. But then your guard has to be so, the radar, your guard has to be so up, because those machloksim are potentially the most explosive. And I'll tell you one piece of personal advice. If you're talking about family, my personal advice is, do anything possible never to get into any such kind of disagreements. Because it is so, especially if you're in Eretz Yisrael where the stakes are so high, because it's almost guaranteed that it's going to go somewhere you don't want it to go. And you have to ask yourself, is there any argument, any issue that is worth that relationship? I can tell you on a personal level, we have relatives who are, let's say, more Haredi than we are. We love them. We have a relationship with them, and I am incredibly conscious to make sure if anything remotely hashkafic starts getting brought up at the table, I switch the topic. Because if we really, really get into something, there's probably going to be a disagreement. I would like to think that it wouldn't become personal and we could disagree agreeably. But I'm not willing to even take that chance. Because family is too important to me. It's not worth it. I'm going to convince him. He's going to convince me. B'shvil ma? So, if we look at every Jew as a cousin, we have to always ask ourselves, whatever this issue is it really worth it? Now, sometimes the answer will be yes, and we'll talk about it, and hopefully we can talk about it productively and healthily. But whenever you talk about something religious, you have to be careful. Antenna, the radar has to be up. It's very, very prone to be something very, very dangerous. And number five, the last point for this is, it's one thing if you yourself are in a disagreement, and hopefully you'll keep the first four things we mentioned, which we'll review in a few minutes anyway. Don't worry if you already forgot them, it's okay. I have notes. Even though I forgot them, I can just turn over the paper. But the fifth one is, so often, we get ourselves involved in machlokas, kind of like own, where it's really not even the one that we're involved in. But it became the issue on the block, in the neighborhood, in the school. And then what happens? Everyone wants to be part of the action. And we pile on. If the hashkacha has you in a disagreement, okay, so now you're in a disagreement, and hopefully you'll make sure to agree, excuse me, hopefully you'll make sure to disagree agreeably. And hopefully you won't make it in a bad way. But okay, you're in a disagreement, so you'll disagree hopefully agreeably. But if you're not even involved, it's not your issue, it's not your kid, it's not your... You know how many people have gotten involved in machloksim about the school that their kids don't go to? Because it's exciting. In the neighborhood, they're talking about it. It's an issue. I want to get involved. They pile on. It has nothing to do with them. And it is just terrible, terrible rishus. The Chedusha Harim, the first Ger Rebbe, he asks the question. Again, it's an obvious question. Read the opening sukkim of the Parsha. Right away, it's an obvious question. Pshuto Shel Mikra. If the Torah tells us the Korach v'Adato, 250 people, we don't know their names, why does the Torah single out by name Dasan v'Aviram and On? Now maybe On was to help teach us the lesson that his wife saved him. But Dasan and Aviram, there's no benefit. There's no reason to think they're any worse than the other 250 people. They get the same end. Why are they mentioned? So the Chedush HaRim makes a point, similar to what we saw from Own, but he makes it to make this point. He says, the other 250 people were primarily from Levi. So again, we understand why they were involved in the Machlokas. They were in the disagreement. They felt they were wronged. They felt Moshe and Aaron had taken too much covet for themselves. What about the other Levim? What about the other cousins? Again, imagine a family, you know, fighting over Yerusha. If you're a grandkid, then you're a bal dover to the Machlokas. Right? Hopefully you'll do it in a men shalchachar, hopefully it won't become a big fight, but you are relevant. Your name is in the document. You're part of the story. But your neighbors, the people, the other people around? So says the Chedush HaRim, we're not defending the 250 people, but at least we could understand what they had to gain. It was their machlokes. They felt wronged. They were wrong, but they felt wronged. What did Dasan Aviram? They had nothing to do with it. In fact, that's what Rashi says. Rashi quotes the Medrash. Oy l'Rosh, oy l'Shcheina. They got involved because Nebuch, their Reuven, and where they were was near, so they overheard what's going on, and they figured, oh, let's get in. Again, it sounds ridiculous, but it's just like you or I, who have a neighbor, or someone we know from a class or some other interaction, and they're telling us about the issue they're having, and it's a real issue, and instead of just being a sympathetic ear, giving advice, that's a good friend, we get all of a sudden involved. Now we're part of the whole machlokas. Who are you? What do you have to do with anything? And did anyone who ever jumped in and apologized, you think they ever made anything better? So says Chlishim, that's what happened with Dasan Aviram. That's why they're singled out. The Avera may have been the same as everyone else, but it was less defensible. They had no business being there. What do they have to do with it? That was the real rishus. And I saw something quite remarkable, a story. There's a very famous rabbinic family in Israel, I think primarily in Yerushalayim, maybe also in Bnei Brak, called the Druks.
think there was a Rav Druk, I think the patriarch of the family, I think was once upon a time, I think he might have been the Rav Rashi, I think of Rechavi maybe, one of the neighbors in Yerushalayim. There are many, many different children, very big Talmid Chacham, very, very talented family. So one of the Rav Druks, I don't remember which one, one of the Rav Druks, in his Sefer on Chumash, he tells the following story. There was once upon a time, there was a very valuable type of currency called the Golden Napoleon. This was an unbelievably rare, unbelievably valuable coin, and people used to put like the life savings into that coin if they had to travel, right? There wasn't, you know, the olden days, it wasn't internet banking and you couldn't wire your money. But you put, this was the way, if you wanted to be really flexible with your cash, you put enormous amounts of money in this coin. There was a particular family in Yerushalayim that had a coin like this. Whatever the reasons were, but they had such a coin. They had it, you know, put away, hidden. So in case you didn't know, when the parents hide things, the kids know where it is. Right? The kids hear everything, they see everything, the kids knew. So one day, a little kid, a nice kid, a little Yankele, he hears big news at school. The makolet has a new thing. It's called lollipops. A new sukkariya. And he wants it. But he doesn't think his parents are going to let him. So he thinks, what's the big deal? He's a little kid. He goes and climbs into the place where he knows his parents have this golden Napoleon. And he's going to use it to buy a lollipop. He brings it to the makolet. He pays for the lollipop with the golden Napoleon. Comes home enjoying his lollipop. His parents see the lollipop. They say, Yanku, how'd you get a lollipop? Went to the makolet. Where'd you buy it? We didn't give you money. So he admits, he didn't ask this. He says, I'm sorry. I took, you know, the coin. You took a coin. From mommy's purse, from Abba's wallet. Which coin? You know the coin over there. The parents are going to have a heart attack. The whole life savings. Oh my gosh. So where did you go? Which makolet? Amram's makolet. So they run to Amram with the little boy. Say, Amram, did our son come in here before? Yes. Did he buy a lollipop with the money? He didn't steal it. He paid me the money. Amram, achlitzbah. How could you take a golden Napoleon worth a fortune for a lollipop? Here, take a little coin. We'll give it back to you. But give us our Napoleon. Amram says, I don't know what you're talking about. He gave me a regular rusted bronze coin. A regular shekel, whatever it was. And they said, screaming, what are you talking about? Our son has no money. He told us he took the money. He told us he took the Napoleon. He gave it to you. And he's screaming, no, I didn't do it. I don't know what you're talking about. So, what happened? The whole community gets up in arms. Look at how Amram did this. He took the money. What a scandal. So, of course, they give him advice. You should go to the rabbis, go to the Dvar. So they go to the Beis Din. They each tell their side of the story. He denies it. They paskin, the Beis Din paskins, that Amram should take a shavua, that he didn't get the golden coin, he didn't get the golden Napoleon, and he's going to be exempt. Why that psak, that psak, that's not our issue now. The bottom line was, Amram says to himself, I didn't take the golden Napoleon, I don't like the idea of taking a shavua, but if this is the only way the Beit Din is going to let me off without having to pay them back a fortune of money, which I don't have, because I didn't get the golden Napoleon, he took the shavua. And you know what happened? The community was up in arms. It's bad enough, Amram's a ganav, and he took advantage of a little kid, Liliankala. Now he takes a shavua. Gevalt. Oh my gosh, it's terrible. And everyone's talking about how terrible Amram is. What do you think happened to his business? Who's going to go to the makolet now? Amram's a ganav. Amram takes shavuas. He was embarrassed. He was humiliated. Terrible. His life was ruined. A few months later, there's a knock at the door. The uncle's parents' house. A man they never saw before, sheepishly embarrassed, says, I want to apologize to you, but I have something that belongs to you. And he gives them the golden Napoleon. Who are you and how'd you get this? It wasn't Amram. So I'll tell you the truth. I am the original owner of the Napoleon. And I'm the one who had sold it because I needed money. Sure enough, he says, I was walking down the street desperate for money a few months ago. Desperate. And all of a sudden I see a little kid walking around with a golden Napoleon. Which I know he obviously not supposed to have. No kid's supposed to have a golden Napoleon. And I say, you know what? I'm going to do a mitzvah. If I grab it from the kid, you know, he'll be scandalized, you know. I'll just tell him, you want to trade, I'll give him a few copper coins for the golden Napoleon. And then I'll give it back to his parents. L'shem Shemayim. And I did that. The kid didn't know the difference. I gave Yanko some gold, some bronze coins. He gave me the gold Napoleon.
What happened? After I had it in my hands, I kept looking, you know, you have no money at home. The refrigerator, the cupboard is bare, there's no food. My kids could really use something. You know what? I'll borrow some money on the collateral of the Napoleon. And when I get that money back, then I'll give it to, you know, then I'll be able to return the debt and I'll give back the Napoleon to the owners. But right now I still need it. And I thought it would just be, you know, chick-chock a few days, I'd get the money and I'd be able to give you back the Napoleon. But then this deal failed and that deal failed and one thing led to another and it took me months. But I finally was able to get enough money to get it back and now I want to give you back the golden Napoleon. So said Rav Druk, after 120, says, who's going to Gehenna? Who's going to Gehenna? Says, the parents who made such a big deal, did they do anything wrong? Not at all. They had every reason to think that Amram really, the Makol really took the money, and they did the right thing. They went to Beis Din. That's what you're supposed to do. Did Amram do the wrong thing? He denied it, which was the truth. He took a shvua. Apparently, honestly, like the Beis Din said. How about this third man? It's a center of Druk. He wasn't a tzaddik. He shouldn't have done it. But after all, he was desperate. His kids were starving. He had no money. It was also to do what he did. But a Russia, he's not. He's not a Russia. You know who's going to get him? The community. The neighborhood. The ones who got all for tumult. And who made Amram's life miserable? Not Yankel or his family. The community, who had nothing to do with this. They should have stayed out of it. But instead, they're the ones who drove him out of business. They're the ones who wouldn't do shidduchim with his children. They were the Dasan and Aviram. They couldn't help themselves. They got all involved. And a machlokes that didn't even have anything to do with them. So quickly, let's review. What are the five things we mentioned for how disagreement could stay a disagreement? That's normal. But hopefully not come to huge, huge, terrible machlokes. So we said, number one, don't make it personal. Keep it about the issues. Number two, make sure you talk it out. Talk to the other side. Very often that could be the difference. Number three, just keep your head. Be calm. You don't need to be a genius. Just keep common sense. Seichel HaYashar. When everyone else is losing their head, not so easy to keep yours. Do your best. Number three, we said, if it's a halachic or religious hashkafa issue, be Zahir Ma'od, be very, very careful. Because whether it's you or the other side, people take that stuff very seriously. That could explode easily. And number five is, if it's not about you, stay out of it. Don't become the Dasan and Aviram. Don't make everything worse by piling on. Now I'd like to just spend a few minutes and address the second question we asked, which is, how come we see in life so often, and we know in our own experience, once we get caught up in something of a machlokes, it's so hard to walk away, so hard to let it go, for it to end. Why do we persist in machlokes, unfortunately, so often? So I think, very briefly, there are three reasons. Number one is, for many of us, this is really a big deal, because I'm right. I'm right. We were wronged. But this is what they did. This is what they said. I'm right. Rabbi, it's the principle of the matter. Now, I don't think people are lying to me or to themselves. But this is how people feel. I'm right. It's very, very hard to let go when that's the case. So I just want to, I understand that because I'm prone to that myself. We all are, it's human. But one thing just to keep in mind. The Pasuk says at the end of the story, Lo yihye kikarach v'adato. How do you understand that Lo yihye? So some mafarshim say it's a tzivui. It's an iser to have a machloket. It's asur. Lo yihye, don't be like Korach. Well, for sure. But Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, again in that same sicha, he said it wasn't just a halacha, it's a nevuah. It was a prediction. Lo yihye kikarach v'adato. There's never going to be another machlokes like the one that Korach had with Moshe. How so? Because in the case of Korach versus Moshe, Moshe was 100% right. And Korach was
100% wrong. We know Moshe, Anav Mikol Adam, at the burning bush, he had no interest in being a leader. B'chol, why was he a leader? Because Hashem told him he had no choice. Did he take it for himself? Did he give it to Aaron because he wanted to give it to... No, it's all from Hashem. Korach was 100% wrong. Says Chaim Shulevitz, that was the one and only time in human history that there was a machlokes, and one side was 100% right, the other side was 100% wrong. The rest of human history, things are much more complicated. Now, sometimes it's 50-50, and sometimes it's 80-20, and sometimes it could even be 90% you're right. But it's not 100%. If you're looking at yourself in the mirror saying, I'm the right one, remember the pasuk, lo yeah, kekarach b'adasar. You might be mostly right. Maybe you are. I'm not saying you're not. You might be majority right. But there's always another side. Maybe it's 5%, 3%, 20%. But if you remember that, you'll start seeing things from other people's perspective. It will significantly help you. If you see the other perspective, that will help you figure out a way out of the maze. Right? Very often we get involved in machlokes. It's like going to those corn mazes. I don't know if they have things like that in Israel, but in America. Right? The problem is when you go to the corn maze, you often get lost. Or maybe the Gottliebs used to get lost in the corn maze. Right, we get involved in machlokas, and we get lost. So remember, number one is, if you think about the fact that you're never 100% right, that is a big way to help you. Number two, what's the other reason why we have such a hard time ending things? We persist with machlokas? So this is similar, but it's not exactly the same thing. It's not just that we're right, it's we get consumed with a need to win. And this is the insight of none other than the Chafetz Chaim. At the end of the Chafetz Chaim's book, Shmiras HaLashon, he has a short essay of a few chapters all about the terrible sin that he describes of machlokes. And there, one of the things the Chafetz Chaim says is, Godol HaYetzer Hara B'midat HaNitzachon. Now, I always thought the Chafetz Chaim was a malach, so I don't know how he understands me so well and all the other human beings. But evidently, the Chafetz Chaim understood human nature even from his lofty perch up there, very close to Shemayim. And he understood that in the real, very real world that most of us occupy, we all love to win. And when we get involved in a machlokes, it's very, very hard to walk away, especially when we're right. Obviously, we're right. And number two is, once I'm in it, once I already have the sunk cost, I'm already in the machlokes, or if I'm in it, I'm in it to win it. It is very, very hard to let go of that. But of course, it's a mistake, because you might have won the machlokes, but you lose in life. And you get consumed with these issues. And last but not least, I think this is the biggest issue. It is just part of who we are as human beings, unfortunately. It is too hard to just say we're sorry, to admit we're wrong, or even if we're right, but just to compromise, to give up on something. It's too hard, once we get into it, to have to in any way acknowledge maybe the other side had a point, maybe I'm wrong a little bit, even if I'm right, but I'm going to give in on 30 or 40% of what really is deserved. It's just so difficult. And I saw this idea quoted in the name of Reb Shlomo Zalman HaKohen Cook. It's Reb Cook's father. And he said the following. We know the end of the story, but this will end. The end of the story is that in order to dramatically and conclusively prove that Aaron was in fact legitimate, so Moshe has the following contest. They each take the mateh. They take the stick, they leave it out. And Moshe says, we'll see, come tomorrow. What happens? The one whose stick will blossom with shkidim, that's going to be the one who's truly been chosen by Hashem. And what, of course, happens? Parach, Mate, Aaron. It's Aaron's stick that blossoms, and we see he's really the chosen one. Now, what did Aaron's stick, staff, what did his Mate blossom with? Torah tells us what it blossomed with. Shkedim, almonds. Ask for Shlomo Zalman Cook, of all the things that it could have blossomed with, why does the Torah, why did Hashem choose almonds, shkedim? He gives a brilliant answer. The Gemara in Masechta Brachos wants to know
What kind of bracha do you make on a certain kind of bitter almond? Hilchos bracha shayla. Tzeitz, shakul, adam. What's the bracha on this type of almond? So the Gemara says that in fact there are two types of almonds. One are a type of almond that starts off very sweet, but the longer it stays on the tree, the more it's mitbashel, the more bitter it gets. You want to get it right in the beginning. The other almond is just opposite. When it first blossoms, it's very, very bitter. But if you let it stay on this tree a little bit longer, then it sweetens. Said of Shlomo Zalman HaKohen Cook, these two types of almonds are the perfect semel, the perfect symbolism for machloket, and then vatranut and shalom. He says, when it comes to machlokes, on the one hand, in the beginning, it's very exciting. It's like a geschmack to be excited. You're all into it. Oh, it's a machlokes. You know, it's, I don't mean you're happy about it. It could be very stressful. But there's a certain surge of energy, of testosterone, of hormones. We're like, oh, it's, you know, you feel alive, battling over something. It could be sweet. But the longer you stay in the machloket, it turns mar. It becomes bitter. You, for your kids, forever, it's horrible. He says, what about making shalom? What about going to the other person and saying, you know what, it's not worth it. I was wrong. Let's make shalom. Said Shlomo Zalman Cook, let's be honest. To do that, it's the most bitter thing. It is so hard. It's mamish bitter. It's so hard. But if you do it, it will become the sweetest thing. It'll be the best thing you ever did to end the machlokas. So that's why that was the perfect metaphor. Machlokas starts off sweet, but it gets very bitter. Shalom is hard to make. It's very hard. It can be very bitter. But it will become so sweet. And I hope and pray that hopefully we can avoid getting into such conflicts. But we can't always. Life is complicated. It's not always by choice. But even if we get into a conflict, try to make sure it doesn't become a machlokes. And if it does become a machlokes, Hashem should guide us, should help us, should help everyone in the whole world, which definitely needs this bracha, to at least pull ourselves out before we completely crash. So that hopefully we can all, individually, our families, our communities, be blessed with only shalom and only good things. Okay?